Well, Holmes, are you going in?
I think I detect impatience in our driver's whistling.
What you detect is merely lack of musicality. You'll be patient enough for the fare and his tip.
And Inspector Hopkins? He'll want to know what you've discovered. I'm rather curious myself.
You'll hear it all, Watson. In good time, in good time. Mr. Hopkins, he must learn patience, as I've tried to teach him before.
But he's in there now, convinced he has solved a most brutal crime, and yet you know he's wrong.
Do you think, Watson, that in my career I can ever have done more harm by discovering a criminal than was done by the crime itself?
Perhaps.
I think so.
Unavoidable at times, surely.
Unavoidable, as I wonder. Might it not be better in such a case to play tricks with the law of England rather than with my own conscience?
You mean conceal evidence?
Yes, Watson. I suppose that is what I mean.
The Abbey Grange by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. Dramatized for radio by Robert Forrest. With Clive Medicine as Sherlock Holmes and Michael Williams as Dr. John Watson. And featuring Penny Downey as Lady Brackenstall and Andrew Wincott as Inspector Hopkins. The Abbey Grange.
To understand how Sherlock Holmes could be driven to consider toying with the law of England, we must go back some few days from that troubling conversation outside Scotland Yard in the winter of 97. Debating with himself the conflicting demands of conscience and legality, Holmes had sat withdrawn and huddled in a corner of our cab, his brows drawn down, face half hidden by the brim of his hat and his upturned collar. But on the morning the case began, distressingly early on a bitterly cold morning, his face was eager, his eyes bright, lit by a candle in his hand as he tugged at my shoulder.
Watson, come on, Watson, wake up.
What is it?
The game's afoot. Up you get.
What game? What time is it?
Almost 6:30. Our cab will be here any moment. Into your clothes now, quickly.
Holmes, I'm not leaving out of bed at 6:30 on the coldest morning of the year without some explanation.
Here's your explanation. A note from Inspector Stanley Hopkins. He has a murder for us. The clever fellow.
Here, Watson. Read it aloud. The effort of concentration may help to awaken your brain.
I am awake. Not happy to be so, but I am.
It's from Marsham, Kent, Abbey Grange.
Oh, I see. Written at 3:30 a.m.
It's admirable precision from Hopkins. Yes. My dear Mr. Holmes, I shall be very glad of your immediate assistance. And you go on.
In what promises to be a most remarkable case.
He's called me in 7 times before, has Hopkins. So on each occasion, his summons has been entirely justified. Let's hope it's so again.
It is something quite in your line, except for releasing the lady.
Releasing the lady? So for releasing the lady, he will see that everything's kept exactly as he found it. Yeah, well, the fellow does try to follow my methods.
I beg you not to lose an instant, as it is difficult to leave Sir Eustace there. Yours faithfully, Stanley Hopkins. Very coherent, is it?
Well, the note does show considerable agitation. Most promising.
No mention of murder.
Sir Eustace, I'll wager, is the victim. The body is left for our inspection.
Oh, well, promising indeed.
Now, what else might be deduced from that note?
Well, seems we're moving in high life. Crackling paper, E.B. monogram, coat of arms, picturesque address.
Not bad, not bad, yes. Well, you're almost awake. And the murder, of course, was committed before 12 last night.
How can you tell that?
By a knowledge of train times and simple reckoning. Local police called in, they communicate with the yard. Hopkins goes out there, he wisely sends for me a fair night's work. Yes, I do think we'll have an interesting morning. Yes. And like the other cases Hopkins has put our way, this one will almost certainly find its way into your collection. You do have some power of selection, Watson, which atones for much I deplore in your narratives.
Not that again.
Yes, that again. Your fatal habit of looking at everything from the point of view of a story instead of a scientific
it's
exercise.
It's too early for this.
You ruin instructive and even classical demonstrations by imbuing them with spurious glamour.
Being dragged from bed at an unearthly hour to inspect some murdered Sir Eustace holds little glamour for me. Why don't you write them yourself?
I will.
You will?
Yes, I propose to compose a textbook which will focus the whole art of detection into one volume.
A runaway success, I'm sure.
Yes, but that will be in my declining years.
Here we are. Charing Cross, next stop Chislehurst, and from there to Abbey Grange.
In the train to Kent, my humour improved very little, as I had to endure further diatribes from Holmes on my tendency to romantic elaboration. A less romantic mind than mine that morning would be difficult to imagine. From Chislehurst, a drive of a couple of miles through narrow country lanes brought us to a park gate, which was opened by an old lodgekeeper whose haggard face bore the reflection of some great disaster. The avenue ran through a noble park between lines of ancient elms, past a frozen lake, and ended in a low, widespread house, pillared in front after the fashion of Palladio. The central part was evidently of a great age and shrouded in ivy, but the large windows showed that modern changes had been carried out, while one wing of the house appeared to be entirely new. And there, to meet us in the open doorway, was the youthful figure and alert, eager face of Inspector Stanley Hopkins.
Mr. Holmes, I'm so glad you were able to come. And you too, Dr. Watson.
Hopkins?
Good of you to think of us, Hopkins.
But the thing is, the information...
Sir Eustace Brackenstall's dead, am I right?
Yes.
Yeah, murdered, I take it?
Yes, his head knocked in with his own poker.
Indeed. Well, seen at the crime first, eh?
Well, the thing is, Mr. Holmes, it's rather... Well, if I had my time over again, I shouldn't have troubled you.
How so?
There isn't much left for you to do. I know who the murderers are.
Well, now, is this remarkable speed and efficiency, or another instance of your losing sight too quickly of possible alternatives? That's an error I detected in you before.
Not this time, Mr. Holmes, I assure you. And you'll have to agree when you've spoken to Lady Brackenstall.
And I hope the conversation will be brief. Miss Mary's already been questioned long enough.
Mr. Holmes, this is the lady's maid, Theresa Rand.
That's right.
She needs rest, sir, and it's my duty to see she gets it.
Of course, we'll be as quick and gentle.
But I suppose you'd better come in, wipe your feet, please, and follow me.
I have told you all that happened, Inspector Hopkins. Could you not repeat it for me?
I think Mr. Holmes would rather hear it from you, Lady Brackenstall.
Facts is facts, whoever speaks them.
It's all right, Theresa.
You should be up in your room, Miss Mary.
Yes, soon. Have you been in the dining room yet, Mr. Holmes?
Not yet, madam.
Then let's get it over with. The sooner we arrange matters, the better.
Horrible it is. Him still lying there.
Your injuries, Lady Brackenstall, have they been properly attended?
Of course they have. Raised her bruises myself with vinegar and water.
And your arms, those red marks?
They are nothing. No connection with last night.
Lady Brackenstall covered her wounded forearm with the large loose sleeve of her silver and blue dressing gown. Her eyes, a more brilliant blue, met mine. This was no ordinary woman.
But thank you for your concern, Dr. Watson. You are very kind.
Perhaps it would simplify matters if Mr. Holmes were to hear your description of the intruders, just as you gave it to me.
Very well. There were three of them. One elderly, the other two much younger. The older man was broad, powerful, with a full beard. The others were just beardless lads.
Like a father and two sons?
They could have been, yes.
You see, Mr. Holmes, that Lewisham gang of burglars.
Three Randalls.
Exactly. Father and sons. Mm. They did a job at Sydenham a fortnight ago and were seen and described.
Well, rather cool of them to do another job so soon and so near, and with their description abroad.
But it's their work, no doubt of it. Now, if you do still want to examine the dining room, we could perhaps let Theresa attend to her mystery.
I'd still prefer to hear Lady Brackenstall's version of events, if she's the strength for it.
Of course, Mr. Holmes. I have the strength.
The lady's gaze on Holmes was unwavering. Seldom have I seen so proud a bearing, so graceful a figure. There was something almost like defiance in her composure and dignity, in spite of the hideous plum-coloured swelling over one eye. It was clear neither her wits nor her courage had been shaken by her terrible experience, although her face, which at another time no doubt would have had a perfect complexion, was drawn and ashen. And her hair, it was long, rich, golden.
As much precise detail as you can remember, Lady Brackenstall.
My husband, Sir Eustace, retired about 10:30. The servants had already gone to their quarters.
Which are where?
I was about to tell you. All the servants, except Teresa, sleep in the modern wing. No sound from the central block could alarm them.
And we're convinced the Randalls must have known this.
Are we?
To act as they did.
Go on, Lady Brackenstall.
I sat in this room until after 11, absorbed in a book. Then I walked round to see all was well before I went upstairs.
Sir Eustace didn't carry out this check.
My husband, Mr. Holmes, was not always to be trusted.
I see. Please continue.
The last room I looked into was the dining room. I went towards the window to make sure it was properly fastened.
The type of window?
French. It forms a door leading to the lawn. The curtains were drawn, but as I came near, I felt the wind blow upon my hair. I flung the curtains aside and found myself face to face with the elderly bearded man that I've already described. He caught me by the wrist, then by the throat.
Villain.
Then struck me a savage blow with his fist.
Damnable villain.
Again those blue eyes shone on mine, and the mingled intelligence, alertness, and recollected terror I saw in them made all too clear the horror this extraordinary woman had been through.
Make sure it's tight now.
Proper tight.
It's tight, old man. She won't wriggle out of that. And you won't squawk, neither.
Help.
My, ain't you that pretty precious? Hope it's clean enough for you.
Doubtful.
That's better gag on that.
Hush up and get busy.
Busy, all right. Could busy myself with this one. Hey, pretty precious.
Leave her be.
But I never had me fun with a real lady before.
Hey, I said, get to that silver.
Where's the bag?
Here. Now fill her up. And who the hell are you?
Hello, old fella. Welcome to the party. Your good lady here's been entertaining all three of us.
Villains!
Yeah, that's us.
Damnable villains! I'll floor all three of you!
Oh, that was a strike and a half. Brain's all over.
He asked for it.
He did. Yeah. With his own poker as well.
Poetic, eh? Come on!
I lost consciousness again.
And no wonder.
But only for a few minutes. When I opened my eyes again, I was still bound to the chair and gagged. And they were still there. The sons were collecting silver from the sideboard. The father was opening a bottle of wine. Then he poured out three glasses.
The gall of it.
Yes, remarkably cool.
They talked foulness together. And they mocked me.
Dear God.
But they harmed me no further. And finally, they left. It must have been quarter of an hour before I got my mouth free. My screams brought Teresa here to my assistance.
I'd have gladly used that poker on anyone that'd get my Miss Mary into the state I found her.
The police were summoned, and that's really all I can tell you, gentlemen.
Thank you, Lady Brackenstall. You've displayed marvellous courage.
Marvellous?
Yes, your story is rich in detail.
If I appear unnaturally calm, Mr. Holmes.
Oh, a common symptom of shock.
Perhaps. But also, although I've been through a terrible ordeal, one thing I do not suffer is grief. My husband, as I've suggested, was a drunkard. And when in drink, a perfect fiend.
Your candour is equal to your courage.
Inspector Hopkins would have told you anyway. The fact is notorious to everyone in the neighbourhood. Perhaps the fault was partly mine. I was brought up in a freer, less conventional atmosphere than here.
Yes, South Australia, I think. Adelaide, perhaps?
That's right.
Holmes, please. Lady Brackenstall, I really do think you should rest.
This English life, with its proprieties and primness, is not congenial to me.
I can imagine.
And can you imagine what it is meant to a woman like me to be tied to that man day and night?
Miss Mary.
Day and night? Sacrilege? A crime to hold that such a marriage is binding? Monstrous law! A,
a curse on this land. Heaven won't let such wickedness endure.
Teresa, take your mistress upstairs.
Oh, that's what I've been trying to do.
Yes, quite right. And while the lady rests, we shall examine the dining room.
You can see, Mr. Holmes, every item in the room corroborates the lady's story.
So it would seem. What items are not here?
Not here?
What did these bold Randalls make off with?
Very little. Half a dozen pieces of plate from the sideboard here. We can only assume they were so disturbed by the death of Sir Eustace that they didn't give themselves time to ransack further.
Yet they gave themselves time to drink a glass of wine.
To steady their nerves.
Mm-hmm. These are the glasses?
Yes.
And untouched since?
Of course.
Remarkable, most remarkable.
In what way?
You see nothing remarkable in these three glasses and their half-empty bottle.
Hmm?
Well. However, let it pass. Perhaps when a man has special knowledge and powers like my own, it rather encourages him to seek a complex explanation when a simpler one's at hand. The three infamous Randalls, known burglars and ruffians, known to have been in the area and seen by a most trustworthy witness. Yes, for you do indeed have a simple and convincing case, Hopkins.
I was sure you'd have to agree.
And this is the window by which they entered?
Yes, but there are no signs there. The ground is iron hard.
As Holmes continued his minute inspection of the room, I looked down at the terrible object which lay spread upon the tiger-skin hearthrug, around which and over which Holmes stepped with appalling indifference. It was the body of a tall, well-made man, about 40 years of age. White teeth grinned through a short black beard. His aquiline features had been handsome, but were convulsed into a spasm of vindictive hatred. He wore a foppish embroidered nightshirt, and his feet were bare. His hands, across which lay a heavy blackthorn stick, were clenched above his head. His head. My God. The whole room bore witness to the savage ferocity of the blow that had struck him down. There was blood even on the chair, yards away, in which Lady Brackenstall had sat bound, and I saw again those large blue eyes of hers, staring in terror above her gagged mouth at the corpse of her fiendish husband and the three brutes who had her in their power.
Good drops.
Only the best, but pretty precious here.
Yeah, and her poor, dearly departed. Keep you in the best, love, did he?
Keep you happy always, did he? Tuck you up cosy at night.
Enough of that, you! Just knock that back and get your nerves together. Then we're out of here.
Ah, my nerves, fine. You're the one that's all a tremble.
I'm the one that had to do the necessary.
Are you with us, Watson?
Mm-hmm. Well, yes, of course.
Gazing at the knots used to bind Lady Brackenstall, I see.
Mm.
Quite right. Can you name them?
Name them?
The knots.
Oh, I'm no authority, but this one, where the cord is attached to the arms, a rolling hitch.
Rolling hitch, correct. And on the cross piece underneath, a clove hitch. It's quite possibly he used a carrick bend to finish the job. And the cord itself is the bell rope, which our knotty rogue, judging by this frayed end, simply tore down from the ceiling there.
That does confirm what the lady has told us.
Yes, causing alarm bells to ring in the kitchen. Knotty and reckless.
Yes, that did give us pause. But as I said before, it seems clear the Randalls had found out much about the house and its habits. They must have known the servants at that hour would have been in bed, too far away.
And you conclude from this they must have been in close league with someone in the house.
You agree?
Well, certainly, I follow your simple and convincing reasoning. Have the maid Teresa brought in.
You will interview her?
If you don't mind, if you can humour me a little longer, to make my journey here not entirely without interest.
You'll talk to her here? With that lying there?
Oh, yes. He won't mind. And he may help to prod Teresa's memory.
And the lady here, she's a bit shivery.
Now take me hanky off, love. Pour a little of this between those juicy lips of yours. My, what big eyes you have.
Enough!
Or I'll welt you next with that poker.
Oh, parental, that is.
Yes, I saw them.
When?
About an hour before I heard my mistress scream.
Yet you took no action.
All I saw was three men out past the lodge gate. No need for action.
So the lady screamed and down you came.
Yes, and found her there. With her very dress spotted with that one's blood.
That one, you little respect for your master.
I never called him master.
You first met him when?
A year passed in July, month after we arrived in London. London ways, with riches and a title, that's what won her to him. He was all honey then.
But the marriage was not so sweet.
The marriage was hell.
I see. Thank you. That will be all. You may go.
Look at him. Still looks the devil he was. Fists still clenched like they often were. Have you any idea what he was capable of?
He mistreated you?
He threw a decanter at me, but it's how he treated her that was hellish.
I think we know all we need to.
Those marks on her arm, you noticed, Doctor. Mm. He did that with a hat pin.
Dear God in heaven.
And her dog. She loved that dog. Had no time for it myself. But to drench it in petroleum and set it alight. Before Miss Mary's very eyes.
The carriage will be round shortly.
Good.
Mr. Holmes seems in no hurry. He's down by the pond, staring at a swan.
He'll be combining facts and details with the utmost finesse and delicacy.
But why does he bother? These are commonplace rogues we're after, and we'll have them. We've alerted every seaport already, and a reward will be offered before evening. That Mr. Holmes should still show interest. It's like a learned specialist troubling himself with a case of measles.
Holmes won't rest until the truth is clear in his own mind as a mathematical equation.
His is an extraordinary talent.
Oh, indeed. He can take violence, misery, terror and disgrace, and make of them an instructive, even classical demonstration.
Bees wing. Bees wing, bees wing.
Two more stations and we're home.
Bees wing and a few plates of silver. Bees.
What are you muttering about?
It's wrong. It's all wrong. How can we leave a case in that condition?
Lady Brackenstall's story was complete. The detail exact. And dreadful.
Hmm? Because she has the looks and intelligence to be a heroine in one of your more riveting tales?
Oh,
and why strike her?
To keep her from screaming.
Oh, I would imagine that a sure way to make a woman scream. And why such limited plunder? And would such men leave a bottle half empty in a bee's wing?
As soon as we reach London, I'm going to the club. You may do as you please.
Your bee's wing! Of course! Come on, Watson.
What?
Out we go.
But the train's moving.
Come on, leap out like a hero in a story.
Holmes, this is insane.
Why not, Watson?
What about the picture?
The picture,
three wine glasses.
From which we're told three men drank.
Yes, there had been wine in all three.
But bee's wing, the sediment in only one. Why?
It was the last glass filled.
Oh, no, no. The bottle was full of it. It's inconceivable that the first two glasses were clear while the third was heavily charged. There is an alternative explanation, as it seems I must be forever reminding Hopkins.
And it is?
That only two glasses were used and the dregs of both poured into a third.
But that would mean...
Yes. The lady is lying.
Oh, no. That I cannot believe.
You must keep in mind that this is not a romantic novel, Watson. If it were, the train to take us back to Abbey Grange would be pulling in now, right on cue. But in reality, by my reckoning, we have fully 23 minutes to wait.
2 hours later, we were back in Abbey Grange. Inspector Hopkins had gone off to report to headquarters. The body of Sir Eustace had been removed. Lady Brackenstall and her maid were closeted away together upstairs. I was sitting in a corner of the dining room, like a student compelled to observe a demonstration of his professor. And Holmes was standing on the mantelpiece.
Holmes, what on earth are you doing up there?
I'm endeavouring to reach the remaining... inches of bell rope on the ceiling.
What for?
But I cannot. Not even with the knee on this.
That bracket won't hold you.
Yes, it will. It's done so before.
You've been up there before?
No, Watson. I haven't been up there before. But I should have been. Someone else has.
Who?
Well, our murderer, I should think. You see? This is the rope he used to bind the lady, the end's frayed.
Well, of course. If he pulled it down from the ceiling,
no,
of course.
No, 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 but he didn't. Oh, no, no.
If you were to pull down a bell rope, where would it break? Hmm? Surely at the spot where it's attached to the wire, but there are 3 inches of rope still up there. No. Our killer, who, by the way, is as strong as a lion, active as a squirrel, and 6'3" in height, our killer needed a rope. But he couldn't tear it down for fear of raising alarm by ringing the bell, so he got himself up on the mantelpiece, did our jolly Jack Squirrel, put his knee on that bracket, the impression still there in the dust, and cut the cord. This end, he was cunning enough to fray with his knife.
Why are you here unannounced, Mr. Holmes?
Because I've one or two more questions for you and your mistress, Teresa.
I won't have her vexed with more questions.
Well, then perhaps you can answer them for us. For instance, this mark on the seat of the chair in which Lady Brackenstall was tied. What is it?
Blood, I suppose. There was plenty of it.
But your mistress was already in the chair when the murder was done. Not so.
Well, there was a lot of blood.
Indeed. And your memory of detail maybe confused the ghastly figure on the floor, your mistress's distress.
Yes, screaming enough to drive anyone out of their wits. Not that Miss Mary ever wanted courage.
Nursed her since she was a baby, have you not?
Yes.
And you came with her to England?
That's right. I'll never leave her.
Your first voyage, was it? From Adelaide to London in June last year.
That is correct, Mr. Holmes. But is it proper you should again cross-examine my maid without my knowledge?
We're sorry to inconvenience you again, Lady Brackenstall.
Lady Brackenstall, I'm convinced you're a much-tried woman, and my desire is to make things easy for you.
Really? This is hardly the tone to make things easy.
My tone may soften if you tell me the truth.
Holmes.
How dare he? I have told you everything.
No. That won't do. You may have heard of any little reputation which I possess. I would stake it all on the fact that your story is an absolute fabrication.
Listen to him. Impudence.
Well, the truth.
I have told you all I know. Now, if you'll excuse me, I'll see that the carriage is brought round for you.
As you wish. Come, Watson, we'll wait outside.
Holmes, that was... It was...
An attempt to elicit the truth.
But to talk in that manner to a lady like that...
I'd hope to shock her into confession.
Confession?
It didn't work. Oh, no matter. There are other ways.
Are we going back to London now?
Yes.
Then why do we have to wait out here? It's freezing.
I wanted one more look at that swan.
Why the sudden interest in ornithology?
You see, the pond is frozen over.
Yes, so am I.
And a hole's been broken in the ice for the convenience of that solitary bird.
And?
You see no other possible convenience?
Nope.
Well, perhaps Inspector Hopkins will see more. I'll write him a note about it. Ah, here's the carriage. Come along.
And so, once again, we attempted the journey to London. This time, we completed it. I said next to nothing on the way, while Holmes expounded theories and threw out speculations, few of which seemed to me to have anything to do with the case in hand. When we finally reached Baker Street, I was exhausted, weighed down by an indefinable foreboding and something like sorrow. I retired early, but my dreams that night were vivid, insistent, ghastly.
You're no ordinary woman.
Pretty precious.
You are kind, very kind.
Long, rich gold.
Poetic, that is.
And mine, pretty precious.
Bees wing, Watson. Bees wing.
Tied to a man like this.
Sailor's knot.
Day and night.
My white teeth grinning from my black.
Strong as a lion, 6'3" and nimble.
All honey, then.
Monstrous.
Such limited plunder.
Dress all spotty.
Sacrilege.
She's just bought a drop of this and more drops all over what?
Wickedness. 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 Wickedness.
Watson.
Wickedness.
Watson, wake up.
Oh, good God. Holmes.
I spent much of the next morning in a cab, driving from place to place across London, sometimes beside a silently concentrating Holmes, sometimes by myself, while he made hurried visits to various offices. Among them was the shipping office of the Adelaide Southampton line, at the end of Pall Mall. Holmes emerged from there with sprightly step and a smile of satisfaction. But that smile had faded by the time we reached Scotland Yard, And so I came to be sitting next to a withdrawn and troubled Holmes, his hat drawn down, his collar turned up, as he wondered aloud as to whether the foremost detective in England should conceal vital evidence from the police. Well, Holmes?
No, I can't do it.
You can't conceal evidence?
No, the other.
You won't tell Hopkins what you know?
What I know is unofficial. What he knows is official. Once he does have all the facts, he must disclose them or be a traitor to his service. Is it right to put him in so painful a position in so doubtful a case?
There's still doubt in your mind as to who the killer is?
None. I must know more before I act.
What's our next move, then?
We shall go in for a word with Hopkins. I can't leave the poor fellow entirely in the dark. Come along.
Mr. Holmes, I believe sometimes that you are a wizard.
I assure you, Hopkins, my powers are not supernatural.
Then how on earth could you know the stolen silver was at the bottom of that pond?
I didn't know it.
But you sent me a note suggesting it.
A suggestion only. The idea came to me that if the silver had been taken by persons who didn't really want it, who took it merely as a blind...
A blind?
Yes, and if it were a blind, only a suggestion, then just outside that French window was a frozen pond.
Of course, with one temptingly convenient little hole in the ice. A most cunning hiding place.
Ah, a hiding place. Yes, that's better. I see it now. It was early, folk upon the roads. Our thieves sank their booty in the pond.
Intending to return for it.
When the coast was clear. Excellent, Mr. Holmes.
Don't praise me, Hopkins. That's another of your simple and convincing theories. Well, yours and Watson's. Any other developments to report?
Yes, a development absolutely fatal to my case.
How so?
The three Randalls were arrested last night.
Well, that's good, surely.
In New York.
Ah, rather difficult for them to commit a murder in Kent the night before.
So, now I must look for another gang of three, and perhaps a new one of which we've never heard.
Well, if you feel you must, we'd best leave you to get on with it. Watson and I have another appointment. Good day to you, Hopkins.
Good day, Mr. Holmes. Dr. Watson.
What other gang is there? So like the Randalls.
None at all, Watson.
Then why let Hopkins think so?
I've given him nothing but the truth. He must act on it as he sees fit.
But not all the truth.
I don't have it all yet.
What's this appointment of ours?
First, the Charing Cross Telegraph Office to arrange the appointment, and then Baker Street.
Two hours later, with dinner over and a cheerful blaze in the fireplace, all was ready for the final scene of this remarkable drama. I was in my customary armchair. Holmes stood with his back to the fire, pipe in hand. And framed in the doorway was a very tall young man, golden-moustached, blue-eyed, with a skin which had been burned by tropical sun.
So, you got my telegram, Captain Croker?
I got it. And here I am, at the hour you said. I hear you've been down at the shipping office.
So I have. The Adelaide-Southampton line, and there I heard nothing but good of you. Loyal, honest, kind-hearted.
But why?
If somewhat hot-headed and excitable when off duty.
I've had no trouble with the law.
I believe it. Mr. Jack Croker, first officer of the Rock of Gibraltar, among whose passengers in June 95 were a Miss Fraser of Adelaide and her maid. First Officer Croker has subsequently been made captain, and his home is in Sydenham, not far from Chester.
Enough of this cat and mouse. What do you want of me?
Firstly, I want your confirmation that on that voyage you made the acquaintance of Miss Fraser.
What if I did?
And you admired her. Deeply.
I loved her.
Love.
From the first day, she was the only woman to me.
And her feelings for you?
From her. Friendship. Good comradeship.
In 95. And now?
Where's this leading? What do you plan to do with me? Arrest me? I don't see what you want.
A full account of what took place at Abbey Grange the night before last. And bear this in mind. I know so much already that I'll see if you go one inch off the straight. Play tricks with me,
and I'll crush you. Be frank, and we'll see. Sit down, Captain Croker.
All right. I'll chance it.
You have little choice.
After that voyage, I never thought to see Mary again.
You heard about her marriage?
Yes, but I didn't grieve. I understood. Title and money? Who could carry them better than she? Then one day, entirely by chance, mind, I met Teresa, and she told me.
Told you how things were with her lady?
Yes. About that drunken hound who dared to raise his hand to her. A woman whose boots he wasn't worthy to lick.
And then you met Mary herself, Lady Brackenstall?
Yes.
More than once?
More than once.
In secret?
Yes.
You deceived her husband?
Yes. I deceived her husband. I deceived the foul brute. And I did more. And I regret nothing. I fear nothing. Except what might happen to Mary. That turns my soul to water.
Tell me about the night before last. At Abbey Grange.
Once more. I had to see her once more before I sailed. I scratched at the window. She was waiting for me. She whispered out to me. She loves me, you see.
And she let you into the dining room through the French window.
No, please, Jack. You must go. This is wrong.
Yes, I know it, Mary. And I will go.
If he finds you here...
But more wrong, wickedly wrong, is you tied to him.
Yes. Oh, yes, it is. It's sacrilege.
Eustace, who the hell are you?
What? Eustace, please.
I am not addressing you, bitch.
Don't you dare, sir.
Dare, is it? It's you that's daring. Spooning there with my pretty precious.
I am a friend to this lady, a friend only.
Lady? Oh,
enough, sir.
Come here, pretty precious.
Oh, leave her be.
Oh, I'll leave her be, all right. I'll tuck her up cozy.
Let her go.
Always after I teach her who's master.
Sir!
Look at her, all a tremble.
Please, please, I've done nothing.
I said, let her go.
On your knees, whore.
Oh.
You damnable villain.
And now I'll welt you too.
I went through him with that poker as if he'd been a rotten pumpkin. And it was a fair fight. See here, on my arm. His first blow.
It was your life or his?
Yes, but more than that, it was his life or hers.
Good man.
Let's stay with the facts, shall we? What happened then?
Well, the maid, Teresa, came down. She heard Mary scream and him roaring.
And while she comforted her mistress, you opened a bottle of wine.
Here, Mary, drink this.
Oh, dear God. Jack.
Look, it'll be all right. Calm yourself and you'll understand.
He's dead. We've killed him. Thank God for it. And Jack Croker. But what will become of us? What have we done?
You've done nothing.
But I have, I have. It was my fault.
No. There's no fault in you. I'll go to the police.
No.
I must. I'll explain it all. They're bound to see you're in no way to blame. And he was a madman. That's only the truth.
Do you read the newspapers, Jack Croker?
What?
You should. You'd know then that there's a brutal gang of villains at work around here. I can even describe them to you.
What's it to do with this?
This? Well, this looks like their work to me. And what did they do next?
Teresa, have you lost your mind?
No. I'm the only one that hasn't, Miss Mary.
And I can tell you what they do next, these Randalls. That's their name. Father, two sons, I think, but I can check all that in the papers. They tie you and gag you. That'd be their next move.
Teresa, this
now, is... Now, where'd they find the rope?
I knew it. I knew only an acrobat or a sailor could have got up to that bell rope. And who but a sailor could have tied those knots? But my, I hadn't realized old Teresa is as cunning as she's loyal.
Yes. We really thought the police would never see through it.
The police haven't. And if you choose to disappear in the next 24 hours, I'll promise not to hinder you.
Now I see. But what then? Won't it all come out?
Certainly it'll all come out.
That is unavoidable, Captain.
No. Oh, no. I'm only a sailor, but I know some law. That would mean Mary taken in as an accomplice. Well, you can do what you like with me, but I won't see her in court.
Good man indeed.
Yes, here is a hero for one of your sensational stories, Watson.
And the lady a perfect heroine.
You simply had her in the wrong novel.
So it would seem.
What is this? Some game?
No. An instructive, even classical demonstration.
Of what?
Of British justice. You, Croker, and your lady, and I too, who have given the police only the vaguest hints and suggestions, we are all on trial. Watson here is the jury, and I never met a man more eminently fitted to represent one.
Thank you, Holmes.
So, gentlemen of the jury, what is your verdict?
Not guilty, my lord.
Does this mean that...
You are acquitted, Captain Croker.
How can I thank you? Mr. Holmes, how can Mary and I ever thank you?
Say no more, Captain. So long as the law does not find some other innocent victim, you are safe from me. I suggest you return to the lady in, shall we say, a year? And may her future and yours justify Watson's pronouncement this night.
In The Abbey Grange, Sherlock Holmes was played by Clive Merrison and Dr. Watson by Michael Williams. With Penny Downey as Lady Brackenstall, Christopher Scott as Jack Croker, and Andrew Wincott as Inspector Hopkins. Teresa was played by Kate Binchy, Sir Eustace by Steve Hodson, and the three Randalls by Philip Anthony, Nicholas Murchie, and Julian Rhind Tutt. The violinist was Leonard Friedman. The Abbey Grange was dramatized for radio by Robert Forrest and directed by Patrick Rayner.